From the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, Judge Haywood explains his ruling.
Yanning's record and his fate illuminate the most shattering truth that has emerged from this trial. If he and all of the other defendants had been degraded perverts, if all of the leaders of the Third Reich had been sadistic monsters and maniacs, then these events would have no more moral significance than an earthquake or any other natural catastrophe. But this trial has shown that under a national crisis, ordinary, even able and extraordinary men can delude themselves into the commission of crimes so vast and heinous that they beggar the imagination. No one who has sat through the trial can ever forget them. Men sterilized because of political belief, a mockery made of friendship and faith, the murder of children. How easily it can happen. There are those in our own country, too, who today speak of the protection of country, of survival. A decision must be made in the life of every nation. At the very moment when the grasp of the enemy is at his throat, then it seems that the only way to survive is to use the means of the enemy, to rest survival upon what is expedient, to look the other way. Well, the answer to that is survival as what? A country isn't a rock. It's not an extension of oneself. It's what it stands for. It's what it stands for when standing for something is the most difficult. Before the people of the world, let it now be noted that here in our decision, this is what we stand for. Justice, truth, and the value of a single human being.
Thanks for returning to great speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're right now listening to an interview of Tim DeChristopher by Terrence McNally, and Tim is talking about a speech he heard by Naomi Klein.
And she wrapped up the speech by saying that, so if what Obama is talking about is not nearly good enough on climate change, and he is a centrist, and where he's at is the center, then what we need to do is we need to shift the center. And that was such a significant speech for me and a lot of the other local folks who heard that here in Salt Lake. We hosted a re-screening of that speech about a month after Bioneers at our local Unitarian church and had a discussion group along with that where we talked about what it means to shift the center. And one of the things that came out of that for me and along with you know, my thinking on social movements was that you can't shift the center from the center, that it's like rebalancing a scale. Adding more weight onto the center isn't going to shift anything. That to shift the balance of a scale, you need to go to the edges and shift the balance there. That we need to go to the edge of what's considered reasonable and push the boundaries, and that's how the center shifts. And, you know, that's certainly something that conservatives understand very well.
Exactly. As you were saying that, I definitely heard how that's a playbook that they have followed since the 70s.
Absolutely. You know, and, you know, part of the reason that we've regressed for the past 30 years or so on so many progressive issues is that while conservatives have continually pushed those boundaries and taken positions which, when they were first taken, seemed absurd and unreasonable, they continually pushed the boundaries to push the center to the right at the same time that progressives stopped pushing the boundaries in any way. Progressives started thinking in a very short-term way of saying, what kind of rhetoric is going to be necessary to win this short-term battle right now? And saying whatever was necessary for that, even if it was right-wing ideology that was going to get you know, this particular bill passed. That's what they were doing, and we had no cohesive worldview coming out of the left, and so the center continually moved farther and farther to the right with our political system.
Very, very, very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. It's the voice of Tim DeChristopher. His courageous act of civil disobedience, which led to a prison term on federal felonies, is the subject of a documentary, Bitter 70, which opened this past weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country. You can learn more at peacefuluprising.org and bitter70film.com. Okay, so now I hear we've got Naomi's speech, Klein at Bioneers. That's mid-October. A month later, you play that speech. Now we're talking mid-November. So let's take ourselves up to December 19th, 2008, a month later. Was your appearance at the auction part of an organized action of Peaceful Uprising? How many of you were there? What was the plan?
Well, Peaceful Uprising didn't exist at the time.
Ah.
Peaceful Uprising was formed in early 2009, after I disrupted the auction. There was a protest happening outside that was organized by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and I was planning on showing up to that, but also planning on going farther than just holding a sign out on the sidewalk. Before I arrived, I'd made the commitment that I was going to do whatever I could to try to stand in the way of this auction and draw more attention to the corruption that was going on there. I decided that I was going to try to get inside and cause some sort of a disruption. And I didn't know exactly what that might look like maybe making a speech or yelling something. But then when I walked in, the officials said, "Hi, are you here to be a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." Still thinking that signing up to be a bidder would be how I could get inside and
right.
cause some kind of disruption. And it wasn't until I got inside the auction room and saw how things were working and saw that they'd given me this bid card. And with that, I could actually have a significant impact on what was going on. And I could do more than make a symbolic statement, but I could directly stand in the way of what was happening at the same time that I made a symbolic statement.
Very good. Give us a little bit, Tim DeChrister, give us a little bit of background on that auction. It was disputed, I believe, even at the time that it was taking place. It was later invalidated by Ken Salazar after he came in as the Interior Secretary under Obama. What was the situation leading up to that auction?
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy surrounding that auction because it was a confluence of not only the issues around climate change and energy development, but also public land use, which is a very big deal here in Utah. These were lands that were right outside of Canyonlands and Archer's National Parks, and also a lot of issues about a lack of a transparent democracy because the public was largely locked out of decision-making regarding public lands. This auction in particular was an anomaly, even though these auctions are held on a regular basis. This one was the result of an 8-year process of the Bush administration to rewrite the long-term resource management plans that govern how a large body of the Bureau of Land Management land is going to be used. And these were lands that had always been considered off-limits for energy development. And so the Bush administration spent the whole 8 years rewriting those plans to allow areas like this to be developed. And the auction had actually been delayed to allow those new plans to go into effect so that they could have one last auction under the Bush administration before a new administration came in where all these lands were allowed. So it was a very big auction, much bigger than normal, and in areas much more environmentally sensitive and culturally sensitive than had been allowed before. So there was all that controversy surrounding it. There were a lot of critiques because they weren't following some of their normal rules, like notifying the national parks and doing adequate environmental impact statements. To me, the most pressing of those rules that they weren't following was a law that went into effect in 2001, requiring the Bureau of Land Management and all the other agencies in the Department of the Interior to weigh the impacts of climate change with all the major decisions that they made, particularly with resource development.
Okay.
And that law was completely ignored throughout the Bush administration.
Yeah, see, I hadn't noticed kind of the essence of that December 19th, 2008 date, but that's it, isn't it? That we've already – the elections was a month ago, and then the inauguration will be less than a month or a month or so in the future. And so this is a last bit of business before they walk out the door. That's the voice of Tim DeChrister. We're talking about his actions on that date, December 19, 2008, and the consequences and the meaning, all laid out in the documentary film Bitter 70, which has opened in Los Angeles and other places around the country recently and will kind of roll out in theaters and in independent screenings over the next over the next coming months. So you're sitting there. You've got a bidding paddle. My guess is you don't bid on the first parcel. At what point do you raise your hand and start bidding?
Well, I actually started bidding without winning any parcels originally. The parcels were going for around $10 or $12 an acre. Some of them were going for as little as $2 an acre. And so I started originally just to drive up the prices. And I would wait for it to get down to one bidder where it was going once, going twice. And then I jump in. And start driving the price up and get out before I won anything. And that was being effective. I mean, some of them they would be going once, going twice at $15 an acre, and then I would jump in and drive them up to $240 an acre. And, somebody else was winning the parcel at $240 an acre rather than $15. So I you know, I was being effective in that way.
You were at least making them pay a bit more for what they were doing.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Next attack is coming. I heard it on TV. Some important politicians said we've got to drive them into the sea. Round up all the Arabs, send them back from where they came. Who cares if they are citizens? They're fanatics all the same. The next attack is coming, said dictators west and east. And New York cannot rest until all the rebels are deceased. So send along those helicopters, and we will shoot them all. And we'll cut social services and build a shopping mall. The next attack is coming, said the CEO. So we need to drill for oil, build more pipelines, don't you know? If these Arabs do not like it, and we need the military here, the American people will support us, whether out of greed or fear. The next attack is coming. I heard an Afghan child say, my family was killed by a plane the other day. And when I grow up, I will get them back. So I say, beware, America. Here comes the next attack. The next attack is coming, said Cheney to his men. And if it doesn't, we can make one happen again. Every war we've ever been in was started with a lie. And this war is good business, so today's the day for you to die. The next attack is coming.
And now back to Tim DeChristopher being interviewed by Terrence McNally.
Then when does it change?
Well, I mean, I was seeing that, you know, the oil industry knew that these parcels were worth an order of magnitude more than they were paying for them, but it was still worth their while to buy them. You know, so I knew that those were resources that were still going to be exploited, and as long as they were, as long as the oil industry was still winning those parcels, it was obviously still a good deal for them.
That's right. What I get from what you're saying is the higher they're willing to pay, the more likely they're going to drill.
Right. So I decided I had to go all in and actually start winning parcels. You know, I was went there with the mindset of doing a protest, of being disruptive. So I wasn't really being very subtle. And I started winning every single parcel, one after another. And I won 14 in a row and was making it pretty clear that I was there as an act of protest, before they finally stopped the auction, took me out, and some law enforcement agents then began questioning me. And I was very open with them, about telling them, what I was doing and why I felt like this was necessary, in the face of, our government's disregard for the rule of law, and lack of action on the climate crisis.
Okay, again, getting into your personal, what goes on inside the individual human, when you shift from driving up the price to winning the bids, there must be something going on another track in your brain about how the consequences, the potential consequences for you have just shifted as well. What is going on inside of you at that moment?
Well, you know, that internal dialogue about the consequences was something that was going on while I was driving up the prices. You know, I knew that if I started winning parcels, that I would likely be prosecuted. I would probably go to jail for a couple of years. And so I was, you know, building the commitment to be okay with those consequences. And there was kind of that tension of, whether or not those consequences were worth it at that time. And I made the decision that they were, which is why I continued going forward. Once I made that shift of actually going all out and winning parcels, that's when a lot of that internal tension really disappeared, and there was a real feeling of calm that came over me at that point, where I knew that I had chosen my path, and I knew that it was too late to turn back, and I was very comfortable with that. That was a very peaceful moment, actually, when I was winning all those parcels.
That's an interesting phenomenon. I'm sure it surprised you even at that moment. And that feeling of calm comes over you. Does that stay with you when you're taken away, when you're arrested, when you're when suddenly the actual consequences start taking place, that feeling stays strong?
Yeah, it really has, and continues to. You know, Edward Abbey once said that sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul, and I think I'd been feeling that tension up until that point, where I knew there was this massive crisis that we were facing, and my action in response to that was, you know, signing petitions and riding my bike and things like that, and I knew that my action was not in line with my sentiment, because my activism was not to the scale of the climate crisis. And once I went all in, I think that was the first time that my action was in line with my sentiment. And I found that the inverse of what Abby was saying was also true, that action in line with our sentiment is the salvation of the soul. And I felt that that kind of internal healing immediately, and have continued to feel that as I went through the process, including when I was in prison. You know, I can really say that internally I was more at peace during that time than I was during that time before the auction, when I knew that stronger action was necessary, but I was too afraid to take it.
That is, that's a very powerful statement. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher about his act of civil disobedience that saved over 20,000 acres of pristine public lands in Utah and landed him in prison for 21 months. The documentary Bitter 70, which tells his story, opened this weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country, and will continue to roll out in theaters and in private screenings over the next few months. To learn more, go to Peaceful Uprising, one word, peacefuluprising.org, an organization that Tim's a co-founder of after his actions at that auction, or Bitter 70 Film, one word, bitter70film.com, the website for the film itself. And there you can find out where screenings are and get in touch with them if you want to hold one. Okay, so now we're in the process where you have been arrested, you've been charged. What did you learn about the justice system in the course of your preparation for your trial that you hadn't known before?
Well, I learned a lot about the huge evolution of our justice system to minimize the role of the jury and the role of normal citizens in the process, and to concentrate power in the hands of government officials, in the hands of judges and prosecutors. And I certainly saw that in action in my case, in addition to the research that I was doing about how commonplace that's become. You know, the first thing that happened in my case was the prosecution filed a motion to limit my defense and say that I couldn't make any arguments about climate change, I couldn't make any arguments about the corruption of the government, or make the general argument called the necessity defense, which is the argument that I acted out of a necessity to prevent a greater harm. And the judge ended up siding with the prosecution on that, which severely curtailed what I was able to argue in my own defense. And then, you know, the result of that was that during my trial, we weren't able to tell the jury a lot of key parts of this story. We weren't able to tell the jury the fact that there had been about 25 other people in the few years before me who had won parcels and not paid for them, and none of them were prosecuted because they were all within the oil industry. We weren't able to talk
about that. By the way, that's the selective prosecution defense, that one that
right.
Other people commit the same act. Basically, they're not prosecuted. This is obviously selective prosecution. That wasn't allowed. Go ahead.
Right. We also weren't able to talk about climate change. And most importantly, we weren't able to talk about the fact that this auction was later overturned because the government admitted that they weren't following their own laws. And, you know, there was a we revisited that issue during the trial when the government had presented a witness who talked all about the laws that the government had to follow in holding this auction and the steps that they went through. And we wanted to be able to cross-examine to talk about the laws that they didn't follow and the regulations that were in place that this official hadn't mentioned, which were largely ignored. And the judge ruled that that to talk about the government breaking laws would confuse the jury. And the judge had this very disrespectful view of ordinary people participating in the legal process. And you know, that's really a huge perversion from the view that our founding fathers had when they set up our legal system with juries as the foundation of that entire process. You know, the people who created our system were very adamant that the jury was should be the most important and the most powerful player in the courtroom, because the role of the jury was to protect our fellow citizens from the government. And people have largely forgotten that that's why we have juries. And so their role has been minimized to the point that not only are they not given information, but they're misled by judges and prosecutors into what their role is and the power that they have. And that's something that I saw, you know, was certainly not unusual with my case. You know, once I got incarcerated and started talking to all the other people who were locked up, you know, I saw that the injustice on display in my case was certainly not unusual. It was the status quo.
Very good. Let me come in just for a second on that. Now, what it leads me to think, Tim, and I have a feeling that it might be the same for you, that originally this seems to be a story about the environment, climate change, and civil disobedience. But there's almost an equally important story about the perversion of the justice system in America. And let me just recommend to listeners a book by Amy Bach called Ordinary Injustice. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but she went around the country and looked at basically the way the system has evolved. And she, one of her contentions, there's a podcast of an hour interview with her on my website. What she found was that the system is not designed to handle jury trials, that given the current capacity of the system and the number of arrests, et cetera, that would be impossible. It is totally designed for everyone to settle, for everyone to plea bargain. And in fact, this is something that I think you allude to, too, is that those people who insist on a trial, who resist the efforts to go along with the system, that their sentence, that will probably impact their sentencing, and they are very likely to get harsher sentences if found guilty because they have demanded what the Founding Fathers promised.
Yeah, and that's something that's taken for granted by almost everyone within our legal system. You know, even defense attorneys will tell their clients right off the bat that if they take it to trial, that they'll get a much, much longer sentence. I mean, anywhere from twice to 10 times longer. You know, in my case, I was offered a plea bargain of 30 days and ended up with a sentence of 24 months. And you know, that's about the scale that I saw with a lot of other folks. And, you know, so that essentially means that the right to a jury trial no longer exists. You know, we have the power to insist on a jury trial, but if you're punished for doing something, then it's not a right. You know, like, there's a lot of things that we have the power to do that we'll be severely punished for.
Right.
Those are not rights. Those are crimes. And basically, jury trials are treated the same way by our legal system now. That, yes, you can do a jury trial, but you will serve much, much longer in prison than you otherwise would.
And as you've pointed out, that the chances of your being found innocent are going to be vastly compromised by the instructions by the judge and by what is disallowed and so on, so that you know, it's not only if found guilty will you be more harshly sentenced, but whatever thoughts you had that a jury would see your point or a jury would see things your way is definitely in the minority.
Yeah, and even the people who end up on the jury probably aren't going to be familiar with what their job is.
That's right.
And the power that they have as a jury, because jury trials are so rare.
Tell us about that scene. Tell us about the scene, Tim, where the prosecution and the judge found out that the jury pool had gotten a pamphlet.
Yeah, it was during the jury selection process. The prosecution and the judge found out that most of the potential jurors had received a pamphlet before they came in on the first day out on the street from the Fully Informed Jurors Association, which is a group that's based out of Montana. And it was a pamphlet that didn't talk anything about my case, but it talked about juries' rights and why we have juries, what the role of a jury is. And it talked about juries being the conscience of the community. And the prosecution really lost it at this point. It was the only time I saw the prosecutor completely flip out in the whole process. And we had to go into the judge's chambers, and the prosecutor was demanding a mistrial and wanted to get rid of the entire jury pool. He said this notion of jurors voting their conscience is just insane. And he was terrified at the notion that jurors had been given this pamphlet and thought that now they could use their conscience. And rather than declare a mistrial, the judge called each juror one at a time into his chambers. And I was in there with my legal team, the prosecution was in there, and the judge was at the head of the table. And to each individual juror, he would say, you understand, you need to disregard everything that's in that pamphlet. Because your job is not to decide what's right or wrong. Your job is to listen to what I say the law says, and you have to enforce it, even if you think it's morally wrong. Can you do that? Can you do what I ask you to do, even if you think it's morally wrong? And unless they said yes, they weren't on the jury. But I sat there and watched one juror after another say, yes, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, even if I think it's morally wrong. And that was really the moment when I knew that I was going to be convicted. I think that was probably the most significant point in the entire legal process that I went through, was that moment in the judge's chambers, where one person after another said that they would follow any instructions of the judge, even if they think it's morally wrong. And that's an extreme perversion of what the intended role of the jury is supposed to be and the way that our system is supposed to work.
Right.
From the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, defendant Dr. Janning commends Judge Haywood's verdict.
By all that is right in this world, your verdict was a just one.
Thank you. What you said in the courtroom, it needed to be said.
Judge Haywood, the reason I asked you to come, those people, those millions of people, I never knew it would come to that. You must believe it. You must believe it.
Hey, Your Honor, it came to that the first time you sentenced a man to death you knew to be innocent.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.